Hi everyone, I'm Celia Keenan-Bolger, and this is Sunday Pancakes, a podcast to nourish your head and heart any day of the week. How are we all doing? We have had really beautiful weather in New York City this past week, and I was sitting in Washington Square yesterday and thinking about spring and how this time of year has always made me feel a little bit depressed. And I can't tell what that's about because I really do like more hours of daylight and shedding layers of cold winter clothes for warmer weather. I love flowers and the blossoming trees. I mean, I feel like I love a season change, but there has always been something about spring that bums me out. And I was remembering this conversation before the pandemic where I was talking to a friend and I was like, you know, I think I prefer fall. And he was like, yeah, that's when everything is dying. Spring is rebirth. And as I'm remembering that, I wonder if there is something in that rebirth that feels hard, that like spring means growing pains of some sort, or this idea that I should emerge from the winter a better, brighter, lighter person. And there was a lot of talk in this week's conversation about growth and how we keep ourselves from not being stagnant and how we keep growing and evolving both as artists and as humans. And all of this talk about growth seemed really appropriate because I actually met today's guest while she was still in high school, and I was teaching at a summer program at the University of Michigan. And I remember on one of the first days, everyone had to get up and sing for the group. And I think it was pretty nerve-wracking for everyone because these students had been chosen from all over the country. And I think suddenly, instead of being a big fish in a small pond, they were just a fish among a lot of other really talented fish. But there was something about this young person that stood out to me, and it was not her voice, which was spectacular and sort of crazy in its abilities, but it was this light and confidence that she possessed as a junior in high school that said, I'm comfortable in my own skin and I love this thing that is being asked of me. And that was actually what distinguished her from all of those other very talented fish. And then she moved to New York City, and I was so excited when she was cast in Les Miserables as the youngest ever Fantine, and then she starred in the hit musical Mean Girls. She was working on the Broadway production of Flying Over Sunset when everything shut down last March. And while she has been doing all of these jobs, she has given me great book recommendations over Instagram. I've watched her engage in issues that are meaningful to her and our society. And I think she has really shown up as a young person in our industry who's not only enormously talented, but has energy directed towards a world that is bigger than our Broadway community. So I am really happy to welcome Erica Henningsen to the podcast.
I'm very, very happy to be here.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I am in the same four walls that I've been in since, when was that, March? For the first 6 months, I was just sort of nesting. So I loved it. It was a nice little break that was kind of sprung upon us. That's just gone on a bit longer than we anticipated.
Yes, sure. And do you live alone?
I don't. I live with my dog, Lennox, and my boyfriend, Kyle Seelig. It's the first person I've ever lived with. And it's going well. You've heard it here, folks.
That's right. I mean, I do think the move from being by oneself to sharing a space is, I think moving in general is a really big deal, but especially cohabitating brings up all sorts of things because usually the last time we cohabitated was when we were not a grown-up.
Exactly. I was thinking about, I'm so grateful that you brought up that that moment that we got to meet at Michigan, because that was the first time I had really ever been away from home. And that was sort of like the first time I had been separate from my family doing this exciting thing. And I started sweating just listening to you talking about how nerve-wracking that day definitely was. And I was like, oh, I miss feeling adrenaline. I haven't felt adrenaline in a while.
I feel like you have worked so consistently since you got out of school, and just what it felt like to be faced with so much time, and particularly because you did Mean Girls, I think, for 3 years. Is that right?
Yeah, 3 years in total from sort of first rehearsal to last show. Yeah, three.
That's such a long time to dedicate to a creative project.
As excited as I was to be in Flying Over Sunset, I remember a huge thing underneath that was, I need to do this because I have to. I have to prove that there's another phase beyond being in this commercial musical. So,
and does that come from yourself, or does that come from a sort of outside pressure?
I think it comes from me. And I think it comes also from the way that we, you know, something I've always wanted to create is sort of like the backstory Wikipedia page, which is when you read about somebody, you only see, of course, what happened year to year or every 2 years, and you don't see all the stuff that happens in between. And I think growing up, the people that I admired or the careers that I wanted to emulate, I just thought like, oh, there's no downtime. You just go from one thing to the next. Or there's no, you know, fallow time. I've been calling this year like the fallow time, where seeds are sort of being planted and the new crop rotation is going to grow hopefully in a couple months. And I think it does come from me, and a fear of, I'm the youngest sibling. I'm the youngest of three girls. And I do think there's a little fear of like being left behind. which I've never really, you know, and my sisters are amazing and we're very close, and that's nothing that they did. It's just when you're the youngest, you don't want to be left in the dust. You're just the little one. And so I've been sitting on that sort of thought during this year, because I just am realizing like we all move at such different paces, and there's no sort of timeline or deadline for the career or life you want to have. And I feel that for these young people who are graduating, I just am like, I wish I could just say there's no, be it a year from now or 5 years from now, it doesn't mean anything. You just arrive when you arrive.
I feel like I've heard you talk about your sisters before, and I think we share in common that we feel very bound to our siblings. And I think also your siblings are really high achievers as well. And will you just talk about what it's like, and particularly as three women, like how, just a little bit more about the effect that you feel like it had on you
growing up? I don't know if it's because our oldest just set such an amazing example that we all kind of fell in line behind it. But they have all sort of found their niche and excelled in it at young ages, and are very intelligent and very driven. And I do think that there was no pressure that I think I felt from my parents. It was more just the example that was set for me by my sisters felt like, well, that's the way to exist. And I am interested in, even we've gotten closer as we've gotten older, and there's been sort of a growing phase of me going from feeling like the youngest and the baby to just being one of them, just being one of the girls. And I think you're so right that something about three women is a very interesting environment to grow up in. And I don't want to put this, this is no blame on my sisters, but I think there's an era of competition that can happen if you're in a family of three girls, especially when two of them are just so intelligent and beautiful and accomplished. And I noticed when I got to college, like you said, the idea of the fish keeps coming back to me, because I love doing this so much. And the only thing that has ever gotten in the way of the joy has been when those feelings of like younger sibling competition have come back up. And especially, I think Mean Girls was kind of a beautiful reckoning of that because we had a cast of like 5-6 leading women. And I just realized perhaps because of what role I was playing, just sort of in the central location of those leading ladies, that like nothing can work. Nothing can be successful if, as a story, as a project, as anything, if we are like running a race that nobody is aware of, because we all have the same goal. And the goal in the show was we want to put on something that people love and connect to. So there's no room for that competition. But it was very interesting to be in a space again and to feel sometimes that little sibling energy come up in me and to have to recognize it. And I don't want to say suppress it, but understand that it's based in something from, you know, being 12, 13 years old.
It was also so amazing to me. I mean, watching Mean Girls, I was like, I cannot believe how many women from the University of Michigan are on that stage. And I felt both like incredibly moved to see it. But I also thought, you know, there are parts of ourselves that we express in college that we then are able to sort of redefine in jobs once we are like in the industry, and just what it would feel like to have sort of come up with those women and then be placed in another situation, a professional situation, and how one shows up inside of that.
Yeah, that is a really, this is such a unique conversation, because you know what that program is and you know those women. And I, you know, grew up, obviously Taylor had left the program a little earlier, but Ashley Park and I grew up side by side through our years at school together. And I think particularly because I joined the project sort of midway, I didn't do the lab, I didn't do a bunch of the early readings. So there was a lot of this feeling of needing to prove myself very early. And I will always thank Mary Mitchell Campbell for this, our music director, who is just the greatest human being in the world, for taking me aside one day and being like, you're not the little kid. Like, you are here for a reason. You deserve to have insight as much as everybody else. And to sort of place myself on the same level, these people that I had admired in school, as opposed to below, which was, you know, I think one thing that I will always try to do, no matter how much I get to work, is I'm always curious and I always want to learn from the people I'm working with. I never feel like I have all the answers, but what I'm trying to work on is thinking, well, you might have some. You might have some answers. You might have some input that is worthy to hear. And I think that's like straddling that line of knowing that it's collaborative and wanting to raise other people up and wanting to ask the questions and learn from your fellow actor. And then also knowing that you have a voice in the situations as well.
This is like the opposite of creative, but would you feel comfortable talking about what it was like when all of the award season was going on and just how you felt inside of that experience, where the show was getting a lot of attention, but you, like, I'm thinking particularly of the Tonys, and having been in the building both as somebody who has been nominated when somebody that I cared about was not nominated, and also being somebody who wasn't nominated and feeling, you know, just, it's not the crux of, I think, what any of us got into this business for, but I do think it's something that we rarely hear people talk about.
Oh my gosh, I'm so happy that you asked that, because I don't think we talk about it. And I think I have been afraid to talk about it simply because I love the people who were nominated. And it's, you know, and also what you're saying of, we understand that we didn't get into the business because of the awards, but it is a part of it. You can't deny its existence, especially when it's happening in the show you're in the dressing room you're in. And I, you know, I feel really lucky again to have certain, like, to have had mentors on that show, people who I had worked with before, who I think the day that the news sort of came out. And I will say I didn't really prepare for, I was not expectant in any capacity. But I think what was interesting, I was not expectant for me, but then to come to the theater that day and this huge celebration was happening for three humans who I loved and admired their work, and to also be a lead in that show and to wonder, like, am I not at the same, is my work not deserving? And I got some really great, I think Carrie Butler was one of the first people who called me because she's obviously been through this business. Her main thing that she wanted me to take away was that the show nominations for any actor in any show is a sign of success for every single person in that production. And she said, it may not be your time to be the person acknowledged for it, but all those people are succeeding because everybody else on that stage is ensuring that the story comes to life. And it also helped me realign what my purpose in the show was, because I think there were moments where I was like, oh, it's not flashy, or it's not like sexy, or it's, you know, I'm just kind of like the girl. which is, you know, not to diminish, but that time was the first time where I started. I remember doing the show that night and, oh my gosh, pushing like my neck out, trying to be a version of myself that I was not, a version of the character that was not on the page, because I thought, well, she needs to be more X or more Y. And then Carrie and I had that conversation and I realized my service in this show, what I do to tell a story, is to be grounded, is to be the person who keeps the story moving forward in a way that I could be proud of and not think it was less than.
It also just, it does feel strangely connected to what you were just talking about with your siblings. Of like this.
Oh my God. I'm not
like three women. That
they're so
of like feeling a little, mind. Yes. And what, you know, how that can be its own superpower, but how it also can be a part of a thing that you feel like, even if that's not what's happening, it's easy to sort of go back into like a historical part of your life and say, this is my position. I've been in this position many times before.
Wow. I don't think I have ever. It's so obvious to me that that is the connection now, but I do not think until this conversation, I think you should be a therapist, Celia. But it is so true. It's like the younger sibling syndrome that sort of crept back in of like, I'm behind. I am not at the same level as my sisters, as my peers. I need to do anything to be better or to be more interesting or to be more whatever. And it fully crept back in for an extended period of time. Wow.
Do you feel like that thing that's like, I need to do better, I need to be better, like how else does that, does that mostly show up just as in your head as like the ticker tape of like the ways that we are not enough? Or does that, like, how else does that show up for you, do you think?
Oh, goodness. I'm going to steal the word ticker tape because that makes it sound fun.
The ticker tape of whereas in real life.
Exactly.
Not so much.
I think there is a true ticker tape running through my head. I think the other ways it shows up is, and this is sort of like bleeding back into that idea of like, what is the artist that I want to do, is that I became afraid to play and I became obsessed with doing it right. Mm. And because I think, I don't know, I think I have always been somebody who I always want to work hard. And for me, working hard equals success or XYZ. And that ticker tape of all those reasons, I think shows up in a fear of not knowing, being curious, playing, and just honestly kind of being messy. And I think that's definitely where it's showed up as an artist that I don't have. And I'm trying to work through that. And I think as a person, I don't know if this is a byproduct of quarantine where we haven't seen a lot of people, but pretty much a lot of interactions I have now, I'd say 25%, I walk away thinking, what did I just say? Did that person? I think I just have a little bit of self-doubt sometimes, but especially these days, because I just don't think we, for a whole year. We weren't really putting ourselves out there with strangers or acquaintances.
Do you feel like there was a version of yourself that used to be messier and then somehow got sort of shifted into a different kind of mindset?
Yes. Yes.
Interesting.
I don't know if it was byproduct of wanting to set a good example or feeling like I had to behave a certain way, but there is sort of a carefree messiness that I think in my work and in perhaps the way that I show up these days, I think sometimes keeps me in like a bit of a box. I feel like a little rigid that I'm trying to sift through.
Mm-hmm. I feel like this past year, I've been reading so much about this sort of the white supremacist mindset of perfection and how I never ever thought about those two things together. But this idea of getting it right and that it's actually better to not put anything out if it's not going to be perfect, and how sort of paralyzing that can be. And I think depending on where, you know, whatever spaces we move into, we can feel that pressure to greater or lesser degrees.
Yes.
And just how much, as we get older, I think there's also a really interesting thing that happens in our 20s, which is that there's so much growing that happens in those 10 years where you're just like, I can't even keep up with myself. Like I'm turning over so many things that it feels like life, everything that happens after your 20s, you're like, how am I even going to get through this whole life? Because it's exhausting. When in fact, I think you do settle into more, which is not to say that there are, you know, you're always turning things over, but that
really,
I think your 20s are a time of deep learning and differentiating. And I think for myself, I think it was more like positivity maybe than perfection, though perfection has always been one of my issues as well. But it's just like, I can frame anything in a positive way. Like I can always find the good side of it, and realizing, like acknowledging when things are hard is actually like really helpful and really good in good. Processing. Yes. Hard things.
Yes, totally. I mean, it's that odd thing. I think positivity and perfection almost sort of play into one another in the idea of like, if everything is positive, then it's closer to perfect because perfect is not sad and not difficult and not vulnerable. And I definitely think that has been, I've always felt like a positive person really until this year. And I was talking to Kyle about this. He's like, you're actually becoming a bit more pessimistic and realistic in a good way, where like you're allowed to say things are hard or I don't understand or I'm exhausted or scared. And that's fine. That's good. It's just,
yeah. Well, what do you feel like you have felt scared about?
I think there's two things that I've been afraid about that have sort of vacillated between these 2 years, which is one, the fear to take up any space, because I feel like my voice in the sort of discourse is like not needed right now. And trying to grapple with the idea of you can share yourself and you can have something to say and also be educating and learning and creating more space for other people. So that's been something I've been sort of afraid of. And then I think the other thing is that I will, I feel very lucky that the thing that I wanted to do more than anything, I got to do. And there is a fear I have that I shouldn't say that it's like, oh, it's all downhill from here, because life is long and there's many things. I'm afraid that I won't carve a new path without a bunch of discomfort, or that I will be afraid of the discomfort and just remain stagnant. I think that's my biggest fear as a person or an artist is stagnation. And that doesn't even, I don't even mean in relation to work. I just mean I've figured out how to do one thing and then not learning how to do anything else as a human being in the way I communicate, as an artist, in the way I show up, as an actor, in the way I tell a story. So I think that's become my biggest fear. And I think it's compounded this year because life has been a little stagnant. And I'm trying to figure out like, well, how do I, beyond curiosity, how do you grow into another version of yourself?
I also identify with this idea of learning how to not center ourselves in the narrative, mm-hmm. and what that looks like, particularly inside of our industry right now, where we're trying to do the good work of listening and sharing the space. And I think asking these questions of ourselves is so important. And I also think like something that we just don't talk about enough, and that sort of goes back to the perfectionism of all of this, is that I think being a good ally means making mistakes. And yeah. as somebody who wants to be liked by everyone, and as somebody who wants to be thought of as like, not somebody who makes a lot of big mistakes, it's easy to feel a little paralyzed, I think, when it comes to being a good ally. And that my sister always says, you know, if you're not getting called in, if you're not making mistakes, then you're actually not engaging in the work. And I think that that is really, really true. But the truth is that I think in general, white people's comfort mm-hmm. has always been more important than almost anything. And so my ability to sit in discomfort is a muscle that I think is going to be long exercised.
Yeah. I love that, what your sister said. I think that's so helpful. And I think I have felt sort of some shame or some guilt about anything that feels promotional. And I was talking to my friend Josh about this, and he said, you know, shame and guilt are not a social justice tool. So when you feel that, sit in that and then do something. And that can be sharing your voice and it can be learning, but the fear of messing up keeps you out of the conversation. And that is something that I am grappling with, of feeling guilty paralyzes me. And then I don't even step a toe into the arena of something that I need to learn or need to fail in order to fail forward, is a favorite phrase from our TPAP friends. So I think that's, I'm happy that you're saying that, because I think that's sort of where I'm arriving.
Right. And I think this idea again of like, I want to do it right. I want to show up like in that room. We've had this whole year of reflection, and I've done my reading and I've done my talking with other people. And now I want to put it into action, but I also want to do it right. And those things don't go together, unfortunately.
It's a total like relearning, deprogramming experience. I don't think anybody can get it right in a year's time.
Yeah, it requires a lot of, it requires bravery and discomfort, I think, yeah. on our parts. And that's, you know, that coming out of a year like we've had, that also requires, some serious reserves that we have to tap into and say, like, we're willing to show up and do this work. You just have inspired me so much, and you make me feel really hopeful about this younger generation and what the way that you have used your platform and the things that you care about. And I'm just thinking about you saying like, I'm really worried that I'm going to become sort of not just stagnant in my career, but in my life. And I feel like the first thing I think about with you is like your relationship to stories and to literature, and like just how much I feel like you devour books.
I love books so much.
And I think that that really has an impact on the growth mindset and at least planting ideas about the kind of people that we want to be. And will you talk a little just about, I mean, you have, I feel like there are so many ways that you've been active outside of our community and issues that are important to you, but like in this past year, sort of talk about how that showed up.
One thing that I realized was that, especially with young people, they have such curiosity and want to know how they can help. And I don't think there's a ton of resources to direct them. And especially when it comes to voting, I mean, the first time I voted was in Michigan and I was a California resident. And that process was so confusing and overwhelming to me that I didn't vote the first time I was able to vote. And I shared that with sort of our first time voters because I thought I was an educated individual at age 18. I thought I was relatively aware and I didn't know how to get registered as an out-of-state voter. And that to me, I was like,
they don't make it easy. They don't make it easy on purpose.
They do not make it easy. And so for me, I think it always comes back, I think, to voting because it feels like such a positive way to engage. It feels like the most necessary way to engage. And that in this year, as sort of the world kind of crumbled around us, that felt like one thing that I could control or contribute to. And it also felt like the one thing that we could hopefully get everybody on board for. And I, you know, I think it's very clear based on how I show up, like what side of the political spectrum I fall on. But I tried, my hope is just to engage people in civic discourse is maybe goal one. And so in trying to create something that was sort of nonpartisan, it was just about voting, but it just sort of has reminded me, especially as what's been happening recently in our industry and in the rest of the world, that like I can only do the things that I feel in control of tend to be acts of small service over a sustained amount of time.
Small acts of service over a sustained amount of time. I think that is so beautiful and important. And I think we are, I think so many artists are in it for the marathon and not the sprint. And so we know how to do that. I think it can just sometimes feel, again, it goes back to exactly what we were just talking about. It can feel inadequate. And so we don't take that first step. We don't make the small act of service.
Correct.
As we think about the slow process of reopening, if there was like one thing that you could sort of bring with you from this time, what do you think has showed up, or what do you like, I'm going to lead with this in a way that I didn't before this whole year of isolation?
I think I'm going to lead with my new sort of understanding of time, and that there's so much time and there's so much time for growth and movement that maybe is not visible, but is important to our development as humans. I think I was kind of living on a very regimented, like I went to school, I graduated, I did this, I got this job. It was all kind of falling under this timeline of life that I wasn't even aware I had until that timeline was disrupted. And now that it has been disrupted and we kind of have had a year of just sort of staring into the void of, well, when, and asking when is anything going to be not even happening, but just like stimulating. I think my patience is what I'm hoping I bring back, and my understanding that there's literally no timeline. There's no finish line. And every other person is on their own sort of trajectory. And I think I'm hopeful that that is what I bring back.
Oh, I so appreciate you taking this time to talk to me.
No, I really appreciate it. Thank you for, I'm so grateful for this conversation because I feel like I got to share things that I really haven't ever talked about or been asked.
Something about that conversation made me feel very nostalgic. And I can't tell if it's because Erica and I both went to the University of Michigan or if she made me really think a lot about what it feels like to be in your 20s when I do think you're doing so much growing, even though it doesn't necessarily feel like it. And I cannot stop thinking about the thing that she said about small acts of service over a sustained amount of time. I feel like that is so helpful, especially when we're feeling like there is a lot that needs our attention and a lot of work that needs to be done immediately. For some reason, it's making me think about this plastic jar of caterpillars that just came in the mail for my son, William. And we watched them eat all of this food at the bottom of the jar until they grew huge and spun cocoons and then hung themselves at the top of the jar on the lid. And then we moved the lid into the butterfly habitat where we watched them day after day to see their progress. And y'all, the transformation was not pretty. It was slow and there was blood and struggle and what looked like immense discomfort. And even when they emerged, they did not seem that happy. They seemed a little bit shell-shocked, like they had just been through something big. And they didn't fly immediately. They just sort of took in their surroundings and waited. And for some reason, watching those caterpillars transform into butterflies has actually helped me be a little more gentle with myself. I think this process of growth that we are all going through right now is hard and painful. But if we can think of Erica and continue to show up with small acts of service over a sustained amount of time, I believe we will emerge transformed. Okay, the weekly roundup for this episode. I feel like I've got some good ones this week. The first is an interactive New York Times article called They Believe in Ambitious Women, But They Also See the Costs. And it tracks a group of young women who were first interviewed as Oregon high schoolers in 2016, and they follow up with them now. And just seeing how these women have processed the last 4 years and how for some of them it's really moved them to activism and leadership, and for some of them it has made them totally disillusioned with politics. And there's just a lot of different points of view, and I found it really interesting. The next is an article called How Perfectionism Can Undermine the Work of Dismantling White Supremacy Culture. And I know, I think sometimes when we hear the term white supremacy, like an antenna goes up and it's just like, I don't want to touch that. I'm not a part of that. That I have an image that comes up in my head and it's not me. And what I have been learning this last year is that we all are a part of a white supremacist culture. And in this article, there are also great resources inside of the article, including she references Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria by Beverly Daniel Tatum. And there's a quote that she says that says, if we wait for perfection, we will never break the silence. And I think particularly for myself right now, like saying the right thing, having a perfect response to injustice feels so important. But what it actually does is it just keeps me quiet. And so I recommend this article highly. And then the last is an episode of the Cut podcast called We're All Failing at Being Women. It features the trans author Tori Peters, and she talks a lot about her new book, Detransition Baby, but she also really talks about bridging a gap between cis and trans women, which is a conversation I have not heard that much about. And she really talks about how mothers look to each other all the time for guidance and are constantly asking each other, like, what are you doing about this? How do we do this? And how trans women are similarly in that situation all the time. And that where that Venn diagram overlaps, there is an enormous amount of power, particularly when we all feel like we're sort of failing at our gender. So give that a listen, and then buy Tori Peters' book, Detransition Baby. I'm going to put a link to that butterfly kit that we bought that I cannot recommend enough. I'm going to put a link to the book Exit West that Erica and I both really love in the show notes. I'm so grateful that you're still here with me. If you want to rate and review us, I would be so grateful. If you want to send an email, I would be so grateful. Oh, there's just a lot of gratitude. It is very, very real. I can't wait for the next episode. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. This week's episode was recorded in New York on the lands of the Mohican and Lenape peoples. Sunday Pancakes is produced by me and Rachel Sussman of Plate Spinner Productions, with editing and engineering by Tim Kashani and Ali Rice of Apples and Oranges Arts. The theme music is by Gavin Creel. Special thanks this week to John Conley. Sunday Pancakes is distributed by Playbill.